now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Good news and bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah! See, a United States astro robot becomes a creature of death. Oh.
And Dave.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain.
Back to the House of Pain.
Welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-movie podcast from classic cults and the cheese in between. The movies are B, with Darren Heyman is grade A. I'm your host, Jason Jack and A, and this time, it's warm outside, so you know it must be time to go to summer camp. And we're going to look at Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives. And I'll get to it right after this.
This is between me and Jason. Jason belongs in hell. I'm gonna see who gets there.
To be reminded of what that maniac did here. That's why we changed the name. People want to forget this was Crystal Lake.
Just because our parents keep telling us that Jason was only a legend doesn't mean it wasn't true. What if he did come back here? Looking for the camp counselor that caused him to drown his wife.
We better turn around.
Why?
Because I've seen enough horror movies to know any weirdo wearing a mask is never friendly.
Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Lives, released August 1st, 1986, with an 86-minute running time. Your director is Tom McLaughlin. Now, he is more probably known, well, this is what he's most known. This is his most notable movie he ever made. But some of you might know him from One Dark Night, which helped get him this nod here. One Dark Night was 1983, where he was a writer and a director, just like he is here. He would then go on to direct Date with an Angel, which he also wrote. He was the writer on Fairy Tale, A True Story, and then The Unsaid. But from TV, he was a writer on Amazing Stories. He directed an episode of Freddy's Nightmares. He directed and wrote episodes of Friday the 13th, the series. He would then go on to be the creator and the writer on They Came from Outer Space and The She-Wolf of London. And then 1991, also the television movie, They Come Back. Sometimes They Come Back. Yeah, no, they were trying to get young directors here. They were trying to get people to give them a break to make these movies. You know, that's one of the things. When you look at Paramount trying to make these films, they were not going getting established people because they weren't giving huge budgets, and they had to turn around on a tight budget, get it done, get the movie out. Of course, your producer here, Don Burns, you're getting into the same people again who have made all the other ones when we get into this. Your main star is Tom Matthews and Jennifer Cook, with David Keegan, Renee Jones, Kerry Noonan, Darcy DeMoss, and Tom Fridley rounding out the cast, the bigger names in the cast. Your editor was Bruce Green. Music, of course, by the one and only Harry Manfredini. Music in the actual movie. We'll talk about the soundtrack in a minute. The production company was Terror Inc., distributed by none other than Paramount Studios. On a budget of $3 million with a return of $19.5 million, making it one of the... I mean, that's exactly what they expected to do. It's, I mean, six times your amount you made back. They knew what they were doing. Obviously, if you guys remember when Dad and I talked about Friday the 13th Part 5, A New Beginning, it focused on Tommy going to the... going to the halfway house, and then it turned out to be Roy as the killer. All of that was abandoned. Okay, so let's make sure we're on that track. They meant all that stuff. So that's one of the things that McLaughlin made it explicitly, the idea that this was not going to be a follow-up on Part 5, as if Part 5 was more of a dream or something not there. This is going to pick up after 4, but at the end of 4, when we see Jason slide down the machete and stuff, he's clearly dead and he's buried. But he wanted to make sure that he somehow gonna bring him back, and we'll talk about that in a second. But he also wanted to make sure that he tied in, obviously, elements of action films. He wanted to do gothic horror, a big gothic horror fan, wanted to make sure he tied that in. And then we had some meta humor actually come in here, which is a big thing. And I'll just mention this. We'll mention this quick. Jason Lives is one of the, probably the first in this series ever to get any positive reviews from critics after the original. Obviously, it's become self-referential. There's some self-referential referential humor throughout. In fact, breaking the fourth wall. And it's looked at to be kind of like a prefiguring. This is like, you know, a precursor to things that would come later on in the 90s. It is one of the most beloved ones, even if it's not my favorite of all of them. Although it's Part 4, Part 6, and my favorite is always Part 7. But this is literally one of my favorites. In fact, the zombie trilogy, which we'll talk about in a second, of Jason Voorhees movies, this is number 2 right behind Part 7. But yes, so anyway, here we go. So, following the events of the last film, Tommy Dorsey is released from the local hospital for the criminally insane, right, kind of thing. So we're kind of like, right, so we're kind of nodding to it, but we're kind of not talking about Roy anymore. It's kind of sketch how this stuff happens. I've always read it like Part 5 didn't occur and Tommy went away because he needed help, but we never have, 5 wouldn't have, I don't know. It's, be as it may, the whole idea is that Tommy Jarvis is not going to be Jason Voorhees here. So sorry if that's a spoiler alert for a movie that is literally like 40 years old. Still suffering from flashbacks of the mass murders of Jason Voorhees, whom he killed several years ago, Tommy returns to Crystal Lake, now called Forest Green, to confront his fears along with his friend Alan Hawes. Now, Alan is played, of course, by Horshack from Welcome Back, Kata. And immediately, that's a nod for any of us who are a certain age who watch those things. Here we go. So, they visit the grave during a thunderstorm, because that's a good idea. Intending to cremate the killer's body and finally end Tommy's nightmares. After digging up the corpse, Tommy experiences another flashback to his last encounter with Jason. As he furiously impales Jason's body with a metal fence post, 2 lightning bolts strike the post. This restores Jason immediately and gives him superhuman strength. This is what I'm talking about, the zombie trilogy. This is the start of the zombie trilogy. 6, 7, and 8 are the zombie movies, where Jason Voorhees is an undead. Like, this creates the mythology of Jason Voorhees as the undead killer, zombie. This is no longer redneck backwater hick. This is now, he's rotting. He's like damaged and stuff. So Jason comes out of the grave. He now has, of course, the the fence post that went through him. It's a great visual of him standing with the fence post. After killing Hawes, Jason dons his hockey mask, which Tommy has brought. Tommy flees to the sheriff's office, where he attempts to warn the police of Jason's return. Instead, Tommy's arrested and jailed by the sheriff, Mike Garris, who's aware of Tommy's institutionalization. Sheriff Garris, of course, named after Mick Garris, right? This is Mike Garris, named after Mick Garris. There's a lot of in-jokes in this movie. Sheriff Garris pressures to Tommy, presumes that Tommy has hallucinated Jason's return on the road to the camp counselors. Darren and Robinson and Lisbeth Mott got lost looking for Camp Forest Green. They discovered Jason in their little VW bug, and they proceed to get murdered. It is hysterical. There's a lot of like kind of quips back and forth. Darren gets out with a little pistol, and he shoots Jason, which to no effect. Jason then, of course, eviscerates him. There's a scene where Jason puts the wrought iron piece of fencing through the windshield to try to stab at Lisbeth. Now, Lisbeth is played by Tom McLaughlin's actual wife. And when it hits the windshield, it goes offline, and it nearly actually killed her, which is one of those things that's funny now, but not so funny then. And he winds up murdering her. And of course, there's a scene where she tries to offer him money, but he doesn't. He stabs her in the face and she drowns in the puddle. And then what winds up happening is the American Express card floats away. Just classic, classic stuff. This is the kind of stuff that makes this movie so endearing to those of us who love it, and to some people who hate these kind of movies, the epic eye roll would start there. The following morning, Garris's daughter Megan, a blonde with a wild streak, arrives at his station along with her friends Sissy Baker, Court Andrews, and Lisbeth's sister Paula. The four teenagers report that Darren and Lisbeth are missing. Tommy warns them about Jason, who is now considered an urban legend. Despite her prompt attraction to him, Megan isn't sure whether to believe Tommy. In the woods, Jason happens upon a corporate paintball game. Now, this paintball game, I'll tell you, again, this is why this movie is so endearing to those of us who love this movie. Everyone's kind of a caricature, I get that, but it's funny because you knew people like this. This is so 80s. Like, the overly aggressive, misogynistic guy, the guy who all he wants to do is eat, the other guy who thinks he's like a weekend hero and whatever, and all kind of thing. Anyway. Where Jason, he comes upon this paintball game, and then he crushes Bert, who's the guy who's a misogynist, kind of like who hates women, right? He smashes his face into the tree where there's someone has carved a smiley face and paints it red. He decapitates all three other players with one fell swoop of his machete, which he has now taken off of Bert. And then we finally see Roy, who shoots him with a paintball and then runs away. Now, we never see Jason kill Roy. Just saying, we never see him kill Roy. Well, he kills him because we find little pieces of Roy later, but we never see it on screen, just so in case anyone was worried. As children arrive at Camp Forest Green, the teen counselors do their best to run the camp. They keep wondering what has happened to Darren and Lisbeth. Meanwhile, Sheriff Garris opts to transfer Tommy out of his jurisdiction to prevent anyone from hearing of his rants about Jason's return. On his way out of town, Tommy makes a run for the grave, which Martin, the caretaker, has covered up to deny any responsibility for the grave being robbed. Hawks' body is buried in Jason's place. A handcuffed Tommy is escorted out of town by the sheriff, who threatens him if he ever returns. Now, this is where we get the turn to the camera. They also have the Martin says, "What do you think? I'm a fart head?" And they cut to a scene of the kids going, "Yeah," which is not tied to him at all. It's the kind of stuff that, all those things make this movie endearing. All those things are so 80s and so much a part of this whole genre. That night, Jason butchers Martin along with Steven and Annette as a nearby couple who witnesses the murder. That was added later. They were not in it originally. They wanted to get the kills up. So the couple that gets killed later, is done up there. That's added. That was added in after, when they were trying to up the body count. Meanwhile, Court meets with a girl named Nikki, Jason stalks Court and Nikki in the RV and lures them outside. Okay, so the RV is rocking. There's music blasting, and they're obviously in the throes of passion. And Jason kind of gives it a look with a head tilt like a dog would. It's so, like, cool, the things they put in here. Obviously, he has to do his full acting without, like, Freddy, where he can talk. Just like Michael Myers, or just like, Pinhead talks, obviously. But like Jason and Michael Myers, they have to do all their expression through suit acting with no, like the way a suit actor would have to do. They can't express, they expect emotion and everything else without being able to see their face. So he lures them out, where am I here? So Jason stalks Court and Nikki in the RV and lures them outside, but the teens, they drive away. Jason pulls Nikki into the RV's bathroom and kills her. Where he smashes her face right through the wall, which is just a great face. They shot that underwater in reverse, that way pulling it out so it looked good. Jason then kills Court, which then flips the RV. And they actually flipped a real RV. And the Gator cooler on the top, the most prized possession of one producer who's trying to keep this thing under budget, absolutely destroyed to everyone's enjoyment. Jason, of course, walks out of this because now he is like, and it looks like a scene out of the Terminator here, which I don't know if they were technically going for that, but him standing out of that kind of looks like the scene at the end of Terminator. When Garrus's men find Nikki's and Court's bodies, Garrus promptly implicates Tommy in the double murder. He's convinced that Tommy's delusions regarding Jason have driven to be berserk. Tommy contacts Megan for helping. Luring Jason back to Crystal Lake, and she agrees. Meanwhile, Jason makes his way to the camp. He kills both Sissy and Paula, but doesn't harm any of the children. Now, this is a great scene where he's face-to-face with a little girl who starts praying, and he walks away from her. And it's funny because you would think, like, well, he doesn't care who he kills. But, like, him not killing the little girl kind of makes sense. He's only killing the teenagers. Jason is trying to get revenge in this grand scheme of this whole thing, for the teenagers who killed his mother, and then the ones who let him drown. And it wasn't little kids who let him drown, but I digress. Anyway, so where am I here? Refrains from killing. Garrus pulls over Tommy and Megan. She points out that Tommy's been with her for the past few hours, therefore he couldn't have killed Court and Nikki. Nonetheless, Garrus locks Tommy up and tells Megan he'll decide what he's going to do with her later. Garrus and the two deputies take he takes two deputies, Thornton and Pappas, head out to the camp to arrest Tommy's non-existent accomplice. Instead, Jason attacks all three lawmen, forcing Garrus to accept that Tommy was right all along. Megan breaks Tommy out of jail. They rush to the camp. Garrus is killed by Jason while trying to protect Megan. Now, the scene there is much longer originally shot. It's him down and he snaps him in half. He was shot down in a hole, and the legs were up, and he bends in completely backwards, but it was cut down so much. The MPAA just absolutely destroyed these movies. They went through and just started cutting it apart. Jason's about to kill Megan when Tommy calls for him from the boat on the lake, remembering his killer Jason. Now remembering who Tommy is, goes after Tommy. Tommy is able, in this struggle, to get a chain around Jason's neck and traps him underwater, but Jason demolishes the boat and drags him underneath the surface. Megan dives in to rescue Tommy. Jason then grabs her leg and pulls her under, or starts pulling her, trying to pull her down. She pushes Jason off and grabs the boat's outboard motor, it takes the outboard motor and starts firing at him. And she hits Jason right in the neck and in the head area with the outboard motor, which causes Jason to start, blood to start boiling up out of the water and stuff. Megan is able to scoop up Tommy and swim back to shore, where she gives him CPR. Tommy says that Jason is finally home. Of course, the final shot of Jason underwater. He's still alive, but powerless to free himself as his eye is open. This movie just loved this. I love this movie. This movie's so good. The thing is with this is that Friday the 13th movies, like, again, some people hate these things. They just hate them with a passion. I know Dad was not a super big fan of the last few, because they're too formulaic, they're too this, they're too whatever. This is exactly what I think every single fan is looking for. This is the kind of stuff we love in our Jason Voorhees movies. The one nice thing about this movie, obviously, is that it gives you the kills. You're no doubt you're looking at Jason. They don't hide them. Everything's out there in the open. 86 minutes, a quick running time. This thing goes by fast.
There's a lot of like funny parts to it if you enjoy that part of it. I know some people don't, but it is, to me, this is, at the time, this was my favorite. Once you know, again, I loved part four, but once I saw part six, I'm like, oh my god, six is the best. And then I saw seven and I was like, yeah, seven's the best. I like seven just from the Jason versus Carrie aspect of it. And it has some of my absolute favorite kills. And it has Zombie Jason, fully evolved Zombie Jason, which is my favorite Jason ever. And it introduces Kane Hodder. This one, of course, not Kane Hodder here. But yeah, and I said I'd mention the soundtrack here. There are some absolute bangers on this soundtrack. He's Back, The Man Behind the Mask by Alice Cooper. Which was from his album Constrictor, is just, I love that song. I've been singing that song for a week. It gets stuck in your head, and I literally have been singing it for a week. It also has, from Constrictor, Teenage Frankenstein, which is just another great Alice Cooper song. Hard Rock Summer, also by Alice Cooper, from his box set, The Lives and Crimes of Alice Cooper. They had made a music video for He's Back, which was combining clips of the film with new footage of Alice Cooper, kind of ahead of its time. And then, of course, I'm No Animal by Felony, which was from their album Vigilante, which is also in the movie. In 2012, La La Records released a limited edition 6-CD box set containing Manfredini's score from the first six Friday the 13th, Unlike 1 through 5, which utilized the film's sound stems as a source of music. Manfredi had originally mastered tapes in the possession, and it was a source was used from that. So, it sold out in less than 24 hours with the disc being reissued in 2019 using the same 28 masters. Now, I said this one got better reviews. It did. The problem is that none of these movies get great reviews. But this one had better reviews than others. And some people felt it may not be the best movie. It may not be a good movie, but it's the best movie in this series. And you were able to appreciate what's there, and it's just to me, this is, up until this point, it's just so good for what you want in a Friday the 13th movie. I'm not looking for you to change up Jason. I'm not looking for you to, you know, give me all new stuff, all new whatever. I'm looking for a guy, you know, let me see him kill people, let me see the Tommy Jarvis story, let's go. And the hard part is that some people would link in 4, 5, and 6 as the Jarvis trilogy, which they are. But like 6, 7, and 8 are the zombie trilogy. And then like you have where 2, 3, and 4 are the redneck, the hillbilly kind of thing. It's how you look at these movies. They are their own entity in themselves, but that they always work in the bigger picture. Of course, as we know with anything else, there was all different kind of stuff that was maybe pitched and whatever. And it's funny because in the novelization, which came out, it features the appearance of Mr. Voorhees, Jason's father, who originally meant to appear in the film but was cut. It also has flashbacks to Jason's childhood, and it has backstories for Tommy and Sheriff Garris, etc., were expanded. The original idea was that a figure was going to come up and pay Martin for caretaking the grave, and that was going to be Jason's father. And then the idea is like, well, what evil could have ever created this monster, because Mrs. Voorhees, you know, had to have a kid with somebody. And the idea was that Mrs. Voorhees was just protecting her son, but this man was truly evil, which is why it drives him. Honestly, again, I don't know because I never saw this shot, but I don't think it would have added. I think it would have convoluted it. It kind of makes me think of, with Halloween's Curse of Michael Myers 6, with the producer's cut and the Blackthorn and all. I don't know. Like, I mean, not that Halloween 6, the actual theatrical cut was great, and I like the producer's cut, but it's just one of those things that, like, sometimes things are cut for a reason, and what we get may not be perfect, but I don't know how much better it would have been if we had changed all that stuff around. I'm of the mindset that 6 is good the way it is. I like 6 the way it is. Now, would I love to see all the extended scenes put back in? Yes. Would I love to see all the kills? Yes. All I'm saying is you can add that gore back in, all that stuff. Of course, because that's what I'm watching this for. I'm not watching Friday the 13th Part 6 for the acting chops of whoever's there, you know, kind of thing. And that's nothing against the actors in the movie. It's just because, let's be honest, I mean, like, it wasn't like we're talking about, you know, this isn't Shakespeare, guys. Like, this is, you know, Jason Voorhees killing people. And yes, I know Tom Matthews was in Return of the Living Dead. I get it. I love Return of the Living Dead. But that's another movie. I'm not watching that for the great acting. I'm watching that for, like, the absolute craziness that movie is. So, yeah. I mean, part six. This to me, is just fun. Just a fun time. And if you've never seen any of the Friday the 13th, you need to watch them in order. But if you haven't revisited part six in a while and you're like, oh, man, I forgot about this one, check it out. This is a fun time. This is one you don't have to take it super serious. You know, have a couple adult beverages if you so choose. Not my take, but you know, you can do that. And just have a good time watching Jason Voorhees cut his way through the counselors on the way to camp. So, all right, folks. I think that about does it for this episode. If you've never watched The Crystal Lake Memories, of course, go watch Crystal Lake Memories. Well worth your time. There's so many behind the scenes stuff with the actors and stuff like that. You know, obviously, you know, you know, Frank Mancuso Jr., who is the producer of these and has been, like, he was the, you know, the guy behind, you know, the Paramount's involvement of, he's the guy behind the Friday the 13th. You know, he has a lot of, I mean, some people blame him when they're bad, but he has a lot of, credit due to him for sticking with this franchise. Now, let's be honest. If someone says to me, I can spend $3 million and make nearly 20, that seems like a no-brainer to me. But yeah, the you know, he wanted to make sure that, you know, whatever might have happened, you know, kind of thing. Mancuso did a lot of, he was involved in a lot of the, in all these movies like this. So again, credit to him as well. So that about does it for me, folks, on what we have here. Again, if you haven't seen it, I think it's well worth going back and watching. At the end of the day, Friday 13th movies, they are not going to be, how to put this nicely, because I know they're big fans, as somebody who has Jason Voorhees tattooed on his arm. They don't have to change your life. They don't have to be deep-rooted messages. They don't have to be, you know, movies you have to, like, ponder and study. They can just be movies you enjoy. They're popcorn movies. I love watching Friday the 13th movies. If I'm ever not feeling great or whatever, I'll throw on a Friday the 13th. And if it's on, I catch it, I watch it. I love the Friday the 13th movies. Some are, you know, better than others, and I admit that. But, like, I love these things. It's just so, they're so easy. They're so comfortable. They're so, you know, to me, they are so 1980s at times. So, but, hey, did you see Friday the 13th in the theater? Were you old enough to go see it back in 86? I was old enough, but ain't no one taking me at 8 years old because my dad hated these things. And he would never take us to see this. Aliens, yes. You know, like, or what, like Red Heat or, you know, Predator. Yeah, of course, RoboCop, 100%. But not these. So anyway. So yeah, did you see them? I'd love to hear from you. You can always shoot us a note here at Boss Bugs and Babes, and then we'll read those emails on the show. And, you know, always, as I always say, thank you very much for your time and dedication to our my little podcast here whether it's Dad or Luke or whoever's joining me. You know, as I've said, things have changed drastically in the last, you know, now almost to getting close to a year. It's like almost getting on to almost 10 months. And I want to thank everyone who stuck with us through this time. It's clearly not been easy on me, and it's clearly not been easy on this show, as you've seen things be on the change. So anyway, thank you for the downloads and listens. And like we say here, keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at 2TrueFreaks.com. Earthdestructiondirective.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots Bugs Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?